Welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Dominic Cavendish, and I'm at the Gielgud Theatre on Shaftesbury Avenue with Tony Ramsay, who was master carpenter here, made so in 1961, and his overall career lasted some 5 decades, from the 1940s to the beginning of the 1990s. I'm delighted to say that he's going to be kind enough to reminisce about his working life, talking about each decade in turn, and he's going to do so in the company of Raymond Boyle, who is the master carpenter at the Gielgud at the moment and was made so after Tony left in 1994. Also in attendance is Abigail Rosen, who was the electric board operator here in 1975 to 1986, and again the assistant stage manager from 1990 to 1991. We have a huge pool of knowledge and talent and memory here, and I'm delighted really to begin by talking to you, Tony, and asking you, what's the first thing that you feel when you walk back into this theatre? This must have been a sort of home for you, was it? Did you feel...
Yes, I got very happy times to remember here. I came here in 1961. Previously, I was at the Piccadilly Theatre as master carpenter, and it got taken over by the Aubrey family. They bought the theatre, and so at that time nobody was very keen on working for the Aubreys. They were very nice people, but I'd heard all sorts of stories about them, so I decided to give in my notice and try for somewhere else. And I was walking along Shaftesbury Avenue one morning, and I met Ian Dow, who was the production manager for HM Tennants, and he said, oh, we're looking for a carpenter for the Globe. It was the Globe in those days, now it's the Gielgud. And he said, would you like the job? And I said, oh yes, of course. And that was in 1961, and I stayed there for 30 years doing lots of shows in that time, and of course many happy memories. Hard work, but very happy times.
Happy times.
Yes. And you notice all the changes that have, of course, taken place, but it was like a second home to me.
Well, we're going to kind of live, as it were, we're going to vicariously live through your life again here. I think some people might want to know, and I'm probably first in the queue to know a little bit before we get to the productions and the life, is what does it mean to be a carpenter and be the master carpenter?
It's a very responsible job, really, because when a new production comes in, it's down to you to organize everything, the staff, the number of people you're going to have, and to fit this thing up as quickly as you can, because time is money. And I've always tried, when I was doing it, to do it as quickly as possible. And I've done so many shows over the years, I can't remember them all, but it was always my thing to do it responsibly. And it paid back, because people knew that they could rely on you to do a good job. And so the phone never stopped ringing. Will you go out with this show? Will you do that show? And that's how it was.
Yeah. So it's a physically demanding job. You get essentially what the set is somewhere, bits of the set are in some location, and they have to, you oversee the entire installation of the set. That's pretty much it. Is that
what
right?
Will happen is the lorry will arrive on a Saturday night, and our job is to take the set from the lorry, off the street, through the door, onto the stage, build it according to the designer's plans. Then once that's complete, the cast arrive. They'll do their rehearsals, and we'll understand then the movement of the show and the mechanisms of the show. We will then sit through the entire run of the show, employing staff to move the scenery. And we will, once the show's finished, maybe after 12 weeks, it would be our job then to break down the scenery, open the dock door, pass it back out through the door, put it back on another lorry, and wave goodbye. So we would look after the scenery for the producer from the moment it arrives at the door of the theatre until the moment it goes away again. So it's the marriage between the designer, the set builder, who's normally, say, outside London, they'll design it in the workshop, then they'll bring it in to the environment that the producer's taken on, in this case, the Gielgud Theatre, and then we will try and force the set to work in the space that is the theatre. Mm. And that way you get to understand how to move things from the fly tower down onto the stage, maybe have a trap door come up through the stage, maybe have the orchestra pit open, maybe have the musicians in, and generally make sure everything fits and works and the manpower is correct and the rhythm of the show is kept up to what the designer wants, what the producer wants, and then ultimately what the director and the cast want to do. Then we settle right back. There's always a kind of transition from the carpenters being all over the stage and everything we do has to be done during the fit up. But once the cast come in, then we stop, we sit right back, and then you have to let the artist take over.
So it's very hands-on. It's not as if you're just, as it were, the labouring functionary who makes it. It's absolutely, you're kind of almost cradling this baby into position. And your people are reporting to you, presumably, so you have the stage crew, is that
yes.
right? And the stage manager even, checking in constantly with the master carpenter, is this going according to plan?
Oh, yes.
The buck stops, really, with you, is that right? Is that how it, backstage?
Yes.
The set, that world, is your dominion.
Before a show comes in, they send in their requirements, what staff they need to fit the show up, what staff they need to run the show, how many stagehands. And so you get all this information, and you usually get a ground plan, which is, in our case, half inch to the foot, and you work it out from there and do everything as quickly as you can.
Mm. So I'm imagining already there are two quite important requirements are, well, a lot of requirements. One is quite a strong sense of maths, is that right? I mean, a strong sense of how things are measured.
Oh, yes.
And all those things align, so that's
quite
important. And also a really quite a strong physical confidence.
Yeah.
Is that right? Did you have those skills early on in your life?
Designers have a bad habit of designing a set which doesn't go in. They use every inch. So very often you have to struggle to get it in to the measurements.
Yeah.
And very often I've had to move a set over 9 inches because it didn't look quite right from the front.
Let's start in a very basic question.
Well,
how do you come to be a carpenter in the theatre world?
During the war, the bombing was on. We lived at Mitcham, my father, mother and my brother. So my father thought, well, I should evacuate his wife and me, the youngest one, to Cumberland. We had some friends up there who had a farm. There was no bombing up there. So we were evacuated. And my mother eventually, she was a very good cook, she got a job as housekeeper to a Mr. A.C. Astor, who owned the theatre in Carlisle, Her Majesty's Theatre. And she said to him one day, could you give my son a job in your theatre? I was about 15 then. So he said, oh yes, certainly. So he gave me a job in his theatre at £2.50 a week. And what I had to do was work the spotlights at night. It was the old-fashioned spotlight with carbons in, and you had to keep these two carbons burning.
Limelight.
And that was the limelight. And so I did that for a while. And then a show came along called Stardust, and it was presented by Jack Taylor of Blackpool. He was the impresario. And I used to help fit up the show on a Monday. So the man said, would you like to come on tour with us? And I said, oh yes, I'd love to. And so we went on tour. And
so this was the wartime?
Oh, in the war, yeah, 1942. And the first date was Huddersfield. And so we used to tour every week, and I began to learn about the theatre and how it worked. And then we finished up at the Kilburn Empire. And I was fitting it up on the Monday, helping. And the manager came round and said, would you like to stop here as head flyman? And I said, oh, yes. He said, I'll give you £4 a week, which was a big rise. So I said, oh, certainly. My father worked in London on the newspapers, so I thought it would be a good idea. I'll see him, and I did. And so I stayed at the Kilburn Empire. But the bombing was going on at that time, so the audiences were getting very small and very few, so they decided to close the place. So the manager said to me, we could transfer you to the Bedford Camden Town, which is still going to run, or otherwise you'll have to leave, I'm afraid. So I said, oh, well, I'll leave. I've got to go in the army soon. I'll be called up. And so I left, and I went home to Brighton, Hastings, where my mother lived, and I got a job delivering bread. I drove a van delivering bread, because there wasn't a lot of work, you see, if you were going to be called up. I didn't have any more. I was called up then, and I was due to join my brother, who was in the Royal Tank Regiment. He'd been through D-Day and the Far East campaign. And so in those days, an elder brother in the army could claim a younger brother to serve in the same unit. And I was waiting to go to join him in Germany. And he went to the Battle of Arnhem and got killed. So I didn't go to his regiment. I was transferred to another unit and sent to Palestine. We used to go to a lot of funerals because there were a lot of men being killed at that time. I was sent to a peaceful place, really. And so eventually I was demobbed in 48 and went home to my mother's, and I thought, now what can I do? And I nearly became a bus driver, but I went to the local theatre in Hastings, and they had a pantomime on, and they were desperate for someone to go in and organise it, so I did the pantomime there. And in them, I got a letter from an electrician who was with White Horse Inn, which was a big musical on tour, had a big revolving stage. And I said, oh, yes. So I went as property master with White Horse Inn. And I had to look after the goats and the pigeons that we used in the show. All done on a revolving stage. I spent 2 years on tour with that.
Was it hard work?
Yeah, I didn't know much about goats at the time, but it seems goats can have a false pregnancy. And these goats arrived, and they looked as if they were pregnant, but I wasn't sure, and I thought, well, they've got to be milked, because their things looked full. So we were at the Hippodrome Brighton for the first date, so I thought, well, I'm going to try and milk them. And so, but as soon as you touch them, you know, they were nearly took off, so I got some of the boys to hold them, and I gently tried to milk them, and eventually they did. I milked them, and of course you've got to do it twice a day, milking the goat, which I used to do. And we called them Gert and Daisy. And goats will eat anything. So on the train call, when we moved, I used to try and get them into the guard's van. The time I had got to the guard's van, they'd eaten my Sunday newspaper. And I used to take a bucket with some food in, and another bucket to milk them with, you see. And so they got very fond of me because they could recognise my voice. And so I used to milk them every day, twice a day. And I said to the company manager, "What am I going to do with all this milk?" He said, "Oh, we'll take it to the local hospital." I said, "Well, at 10 o'clock at night, how can I do that?" So that idea soon fell by the wayside. So eventually I discovered that if you gave them the milk, they'd drink it. So that's what I did. I took it out of one end and gave it to them in the other. And in those days, you didn't travel from theatre to theatre in a lorry. You had to load it all onto a train. Because British Railways, if you bought so many passenger tickets, would give you a truck. A 45-foot long truck that you could load your scenery onto. So you had to get the stuff out of the theatre onto a lorry, take it to the railway station, late at night, of course, on the Saturday, load it onto this railway truck, and then when you got to the next town, you'd have lorries waiting, and you'd have to reverse the thing, take it to the theatre, which was double the work, really. And then eventually, they got around to taking it from theatre to theatre on a lorry. It was just that you got to learn to load it correctly to get it all into this railway truck. And so you'd have to have what they called station men. You'd have a gang of men at the station, and then you'd have another gang of men at the theatre. So you had to take all that into account, you see.
Yes. And did it feel when you were out on the road or on the rail that there were this sort of circuit of travelling actors and companies touring?
Yes, it was meet each other at Stroud railway stations. Yeah, you very often, as you were coming off a train, there'd be another lot coming in.
Yeah.
You'd very often, "Hello, and where are you this week?" "Oh, we're at the King's," or "we're at the Adelphi," or whichever it was.
And I wondered what it was like if you were working on the stage crew side. Were you treated as a class or world apart, or did the company itself kind of muck
into you? It's always been rather upstairs, downstairs. And after White Horse Inn, I was offered a job with Brigadoon, which was a very successful show from Her Majesty's. So I went on tour with Brigadoon, and that was 2 years. Drury Lane for South Pacific. And South Pacific was the first one I did from Drury Lane. That was for a firm called Williamson's Music. And it was really Rodgers and Hammerstein's firm. And someone said, "Would you go on tour with South Pacific?" I said, "Oh, I'd love to." That was 2 years. And then when that finished, King and I, same management. And at Drury Lane, whilst South Pacific was playing downstage, King and I were rehearsing upstage. Just shows you how big a stage it is. They had the whole set up, and they were rehearsing in the daytime upstage, and South Pacific was playing in the evening downstage.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
What was your, I mean, generally, was that, when you talk about being with the show for 2 years, is there a point of fatigue with the show that you get, or did you find that?
Oh, yeah, it's very hard work at weekends.
Yeah.
Because that's when all the work was done, you see. You might do a week in a place, or 2 weeks, and then the big turnover, you see.
Mm.
So you had to face that. And it was very hard work.
Yeah. Did you feel quite like an itinerant, sort of always on the move somehow? I mean, did you like that life, as it were, of the travelling?
Yeah, well, you just got used to it.
Yeah.
You had to get another set of digs. Everybody had a little book with all the addresses in for different towns. And you'd say to people, "Have you got any digs in Blackpool? Do you know any digs in Sheffield?" Wherever you were. And if they had good digs, you'd write them down in your book, you see.
Yeah.
and book them up as soon as you could.
Well, can you remember the worst digs you ever stayed at?
Oh, yes, some of them were dreadful. Oh, yes, I've been in digs where the rain's been coming through the roof onto your bed. And terrible, some of them were. But then there were good ones.
Yeah.
And in those days, you could get full board, as I say, for £2.50. But you could also get what they called a combined room. That was 35 shillings. And for that, you would arrange with the landlady to cook your food. You'd have a room with a bed and a fireplace. And if you wanted sausage and mash, you'd give it to the lady and she'd cook it for you. And that's how it worked. So that was much cheaper.
Yeah. Sounds like a system that should prevail today. I'm sure there are lots of people who'd like to just turn up with a half cuisine.
35 shillings a week, it was a bargain. You know, I got well known because I used to keep going back there, you see. And you'd say to them, who did you have last week? Oh, so-and-so. And what was he like? Oh, he was hopeless. He was hopeless. He didn't know what he was doing. And they didn't like it if you were hopeless because it meant they had to work harder. And if you could do a thing and it were all worked out, they used to appreciate you more.
Yeah. And you actually had a real gift at this sort of work.
Well, I must have.
Without training, really. I mean, you'd learnt on the job.
Yeah, just came from practice.
Yeah.
And so we were at, what show was the last one?
Well, we hadn't quite got to Pajama
Brigadoon, and then
we sort of done a little spate. It was mid-50s. You have Call Me Madam, Kiss Me Kate, South Pacific, The King and I, and The Pyjama Game, all that happens before 1957. And
then I did Time and Again. There were a famous acting couple called Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine from America. They were like the Barrymores. And they came over in a very exciting play called Time and Again, which eventually opened the Royalty Theatre in London. Anyway, I did the tour with them, and we went to Brighton and Stratford-on-Avon we went to, and we also went to Newcastle, and I think from Newcastle it went to America to open a theatre there called the Fontaine Theatre, I think. And yes, that was a good show. And then it came back to the Royalty and opened the Royalty Theatre. And I did the fit up for them again, as I'd done it so many times. Yes, that was an exciting game.
That was actually one of their last big shows, I think, wasn't it? They kind of retired.
Yeah, they were quite elderly then. So, But they were famous actors and actresses.
What was it like then when you were with that production? Was it like Royalty from America had arrived? Were people very excited when it arrived in town?
They used to have a car waiting for them at stage door every night so that they could jump into it and off to the hotel. Oh yes, they really sort of took care of them. This was Tennants, H.M. Tennants.
Yeah.
And they were like Royalty, really. And then after Time and Again, I did Irma La Douce, which was a very big show and a very nice show. And it used to bring the house down every night and the audience would get up and...
Yes, this is the sort of musical about the Parisian prostitute who...
And yes, right.
Interestingly, that was directed by Peter Brook, who was still going and still directing.
Yeah, he was a
But in 1958,
he was a very nice man.
Yeah.
Very nice man, and it was a very heavy show to fit up. And it opened, I think, in Bournemouth, I think, went to Brighton, or vice versa, and then it came into the Lyric Theatre here. But it was a very difficult show to fit up physically because the scenery came on big tracks from off stage and came on stage on big sliders. And it was very difficult to get these tracks level because they weren't made for the job. They were just using old tap tracks. So it was a very hard job to get the actual level so that the things would run along like a curtain track.
So his great visual coup de théâtre was your responsibility.
Otherwise it wouldn't have opened.
Yeah. And were people pushing then quite hard at that point to create more elaborate and sophisticated sets, do you think?
I don't know, but I suppose they were all keen on saving money, so they used cheaper methods. But Elizabeth Seale was the leading lady in that, and she was very popular.
Yeah.
So it had a good run, I think, Irma La Douce.
Yeah.
Lovely show. And then after that, West Side Story. Ian Dow, who was the company manager, the production manager for Tennis, said, "Have you got a passport?" I said, "Oh, yes." He said, "Well, I might want you to go to Moscow to fit up this show because it's on a goodwill tour from America, West Side Story." So I said, okay. So at that time, there was these aeroplanes over. They sent a spy plane over Russia, the Americans.
U2.
And it got shot down. What was the name?
U2.
Yes, that's it. And so the thing was cancelled. Oh. So instead of me going to Moscow, I went to the theatre in Manchester and we opened it there, and from Manchester it came into Her Majesty's.
Yeah.
West Side Story, a very heavy show.
Yeah.
It had a full stage because we had trucks that came down on grooves to guide them, great big truck, where they did the scene from the drugstore where the girl is raped, and it's a big heavy show and a lot of metal work in it. Metal fences and things like that.
Were the American producers and so on, were they very quite demanding in terms of
there was a bloke called Jerry White, I think, was the production manager. And and they said to me, "Now you're getting out at Manchester." There was a lot of lighting in it. There was a lorry load of lamps on its own, apart from the scenery. Then we had all this full stage that took up a great big flat lorry. And he said, "We'd like you to get it all here 5 o'clock on the Sunday," and we'd got it out the previous night, and it took us till nearly all night just to load it up there. Anyway, it got here for 5 o'clock to Her Majesty's, so we beat the dateline. Yeah,
really busting a gut.
Yeah,
and I noticed that production, starred Chita Rivera as Anita. I don't know how conscious you were of all of stars in it, but she's still going incredibly. So I just wondered, did you get swept up in any of the sort of fever around that show in terms of, because it became a huge hit, didn't it?
I used to go down with this truck, went down with the drugstore, what they called the drugstore, and Chita Rivera did her business in there, where she got raped by this gang of men, and I'm behind the truck and she comes off and she's sobbing her eyes out, you know. And I said, "Are you all right, love?" And I put my arm around. Oh, she said, "Don't worry, I do this every night." She that was Chita Rivera.
Yeah.
And fascinating show.
Yeah. So that show ran from from 1958 to 1961. But you were, you were sort of moving between different theatres, Piccadilly Theatre, Carpenter. 61 is when you become the master carpenter at the Globe. So you becoming quite a sort of well-known name in the West End at this point. People going,
See, I was with West Side Story, and someone said, "Why don't you employ Tony Ramsay? He's a good carpenter." This was the Piccadilly Theatre, and that was run by can't remember his name, but very nice man. So he said, would you like to be carpenter at the Piccadilly? So I said, yeah. So I went to the Piccadilly. And as I say, they were taken over by the Albury's. And I didn't want to work for the Albury's. I knew them quite well. Ian Albury was a very nice man. The father was Donald Albury, and Ian was like his son. And I'd been on tour with him with West Side Story. He was with that. And so that's how I got a job there.
Why? What, can I ask why the Albury's weren't particularly to be worked for?
Well, I don't know. They were. I'd always heard that they were rather cheap and cheerful, and I didn't want to work for people like that. So I left them and came here to the Gielgud, the Globe as it was in those days, and that was in 1961.
So you're made Master Carpenter. That's the top post you've had so far.
Yeah.
How old are you then? Can you remember roughly? 61, I suppose.
Well, I don't know. Well, what I'd be then, I suppose, in my 30s.
In your 30s, yeah.
And the first show here was a thing with Maggie Smith in it. She was young and beautiful, a young lady. It's a play called The Rehearsal. So that was
the Jeanne Nui play.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She kind of was becoming a star very quickly, wasn't she, at that point?
Oh, yeah. She was a very nice girl. And we got on very well together. In fact, she said to me one day, would you come to my house and put a shelf up? So I said, yes, yeah, certainly. So she lived behind Harrods, a nice flat. And so I went there. In those days, you could park your car anywhere. There were no parking meters. So I went and parked outside her flat, put the shelf up, and she said, what do I owe you? And I said, well, with the timber and the tile, I said, £3.
Hmm.
And she gave me a £10 note. So she became my favourite actress.
Yeah.
I used to do two shows on the Saturday here, and then jump into my car with my tool bag, go to Brighton, get a show in, fit it up, work all night Saturday. Sunday evening, when it was all done, I'd go back home. And then you'd have to be there at 8 or 8.30 the following morning. So I'd have to drive all the way back to Brighton to continue the fitting up until this Monday night when it opened. And then you'd done your job. And then so you'd be all right until the following weekend when you'd have to go and get it out. At the Globe, as it was in those days, they thought so much of me, they didn't mind me going off and doing these other fit-ups. So I used to do fit-ups for other managements, like Michael Codron, and as long as everything went smoothly here. And I had a jolly good assistant called Maltese Joe, who used to keep things going until I got back. The people who controlled it really was Ian Dow, who was the production manager. He had his offices here. And so I was always on good terms.
And where did you live? Were you having to commute in, or were you living near?
No, I lived in Beckenham, so I had to. At one time, I lived in Longacre when I first started, when I was at the Piccadilly. That was very handy. I could be in any theatre in 5 minutes, more or less. Yeah, that was in Longacre. And then I got married, had children, and they wanted dogs and cats and things. You couldn't do that in the West End.
No.
So we moved to Beckenham. I married, my first marriage was to a dancer out of White Horse Inn. Then my second marriage was to a girl in King and I, one of the Queen's wives, one of the King's wives.
Yes.
And that lasted 18 years. So did quite well the second time.
Yeah, yeah.